Next case is case number 9 SC519, Hassler versus the county process of Larimer County. Set for a half hour, yes, 15 minutes aside. Both parties ready? Please proceed, and just let me, for housekeeping purposes, remind you to state your name for the record, and you'll have to keep track of your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice Bender, justices of the court. May it please the court, I am Larry Dean Valenti, attorney number 31662, on behalf of petitioner Daniel Shane Hassler, who is present in the audience with me today. This case is probably not one of the most sexy cases you're going to hear anytime soon. It involves a statute of limitations, one of those necessary evils of our profession, of a law and order democratic society. The very narrow issue drawn by this court is, was it an error for the district court to uphold the county court, finding that the six-year statute of limitations contained in section 13-80-103.5, subsection 1A of the Colorado Revised Statutes, began to run the day after the sale of the repossessed vehicle, rather than the day after the default of a contract to purchase the vehicle?
Can I ask for a clarification, because your reply brief confused me.
Okay, Your Honor.
Just on the math here. If we were to disagree with you and to rule that it ran after the deficiency was known, the amount of it, does the math work so that the statute of limitations would not have expired?
In the instant case, the math would work. You would still be within a six-year time window. The biggest issue, though, that arises with that, and math is a key issue to this case, is really, though, the starting point. And as I've identified, there were really, in my opinion, three distinct possibilities where this statute could start to run. The first one would be the date of the default occurred.
First default? What? The first failure to pay the amount owed?
Correct.
It's a monthly amount?
It was a monthly amount.
Okay.
First default not to pay and not to cure.
Right.
This was not a situation, we don't have a situation where the April payment was missed, but then the May payment, the June payment, the July payment were made. The April payment was missed, and every subsequent...
No other payment was made.
No other payment was made. One of the very few facts found at the initial proceedings were that April 21st, I believe, 2001, was the last voluntary payment. Okay, so that would be our first possible triggering event. The second possible triggering event would be the repossession of the vehicle, which occurred several months later on the 30th of October in 2001. The third possible triggering event would be the sale of the vehicle, which occurred in June of 2002. When suit was commenced was May of 2008, approximately 5 years, 11 months after that third event, after the deficiency, after was a known amount.
And under any of these other possible accrual dates, the statute would have run?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I see nothing...
Including the possession of that. Just trying to get the dates and times. If repossessing
the vehicle. Yes. Had the court chosen repossession of the vehicle as the starting date, the 6 years would have run from October 30th of 2001 to October 29th, essentially, of 2007. In either instance, though, one of the interesting issues in this case, if you look at the repossession date and the default date, the date of the last voluntary payment, in either of those instances, should this court determine that the repossession was the wrong triggering event, I'm sorry, that the sale was the wrong triggering event, in either of those two instances, we would be outside of the six-year statute of limitations. because suit was not commenced until May of 2008. Okay? Does that help the timeline a little better, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. The reason, however, that it's problematic to look to the date of the sale of the vehicle is that you're looking at a remedy. You're not looking at an act. And there's a little bit of a difference here. In order for a remedy to occur, to be available to use, something else must first occur. In this case, it was the default. Mr. Hassler failed to make his payment and continued to fail to make his payments. Once he defaulted, at that point in time, all of the respondent's remedies became available. Acceleration of the contract, reducing the amount due to a lump sum, repossession of the vehicle, taking an action in the court of law. Those remedies all became available.
I thought there was a doctrine about an installment contract. The default occurred as to each payment, each monthly payment. And so unless acceleration is requested as a remedy you just mentioned, then there really isn't any kind of default until, or at least that would trigger their statute until the sale.
Well, there has been discussion about that doctrine, but I don't believe it applies in this case. Nothing else happened after that April 21st. No payments were made. Nothing occurred. No payments were made. The vehicle was repossessed. Then it was sold. But really, one of the biggest problems with looking at the date of the sale and following the reasoning of the lower court, county court magistrate, is that if you look at the repossession and say you must have a liquidated sum certain to be able to go forward to start the statute of limitations, you're essentially tolling an untollable statute. The statute is very clear. The following actions shall be commenced within 6 years after the cause of action accrues and not thereafter.
Well, I think Chief Justice Bender has a good point here. You don't want forbearance. You might favor forbearance on the part of the creditor in an installment sale situation. So wouldn't the better thing in this case having to do with an automobile be the possession, because it's an election of a remedy that basically acknowledges that there's no more payments that are going to be made to vehicles in the possession of the creditor?
Well, if you follow that reasoning, and that is a possibility, possession of the vehicle by the creditor, by the bank, occurred on the 30th of October 2001. So if you use that as your triggering event, the case was still not timely filed because it was not filed until May of 2008. In either instance, whether you look to the default or saying, okay, they now have the vehicle, that's the point where there could be no more installments made, etc. There's, you know, they've elected a remedy. That point, if that point triggers the 6 years, we are still outside of the bounds. The case would still have been time barred by the statute of limitations.
Now, how much of an interval and why did it take so long to actually sell the vehicle after the possession? We're talking, what, 3 months or something? I just forget the numbers.
Actually, we're talking more like 9 months.
So what's the explanation for that?
The record is very scant. I've seen notes that indicate the time of the year, it was snowing, paperwork issues. In my opinion, it's very murky.
But the point is that 6 years in any event, under your theory, assuming it's triggered possession, is certainly enough time to liquidate, ascertain the amount of deficiency.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you don't even need to liquidate, because if you look to the second part of the statute there, it talks about, or an unliquidated determinable amount of money due. We had a contract. We knew exactly how many payments there were, what the interest was, how much was owed each month. It's very easy to say 10 payments were made at, say, $300 a month, 20 payments remain. It's very simple math. It shouldn't require a Cray supercomputer, for instance, to figure it out.
Wasn't there an obligation, though, to mitigate that damage? To mitigate the damage by selling the car and trying to get some money back on those payments, which in fact, the letter seems to suggest that that's what they're doing, that they sent to Mr. Hassel.
Well, whether or not it's an absolute obligation, I can't say for certain. But I think there's typically under the UCC an obligation, certainly to attempt to mitigate the damages, but it's not mandatory. It's one of the possible remedies. They don't have to elect, for instance, to sell the vehicle. The vehicle can simply be held. There's an instance. The bank could have allowed Mr. Hassler to continue to keep the vehicle.
But I think under the UCC, they pretty much have to make an attempt to mitigate. They can't just keep the car and say you owe the rest of it. The car is now ours.
I would agree with that.
So the law has to account somehow for that attempt to mitigate, for that duty to mitigate, shall I put it.
And I would agree with you on that point, Your Honor.
And so how does the law allow for that duty to mitigate in terms of the statute of limitations? I mean, that's really the issue here. And the question is the time that one takes or that an agency takes to mitigate, does that count against the statute of limitations, or does the statute of limitations not count until that's been done? And why wouldn't it not count until that's been done?
I would say that it has to occur within the boundaries of the statute of limitations.
And what authority would suggest that?
Unfortunately, the authority in this area is very scant, which is, I presume, why we're here today. There's just nothing really concrete. Nobody has ever looked at it from that angle that I can find. But I believe that the UCC duty to mitigate is not a triggering event, but one of the remedial events that can and should occur during the pendency of the statute of limitations.
Do you think that a failure to mitigate would affect the cause of action at all, or simply the amount that would be recoverable, the remedy?
I don't. I think that the failure to mitigate may raise another defense for a trial, for some sort of an offset in the judgment, but I don't believe it has anything to do with time. I think it's one of the actions that can occur during the 6-year window of time. Your Honors, at this point, I would like to reserve the bulk of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Adam Plotkin, and I represent the Appalachian account brokers in this matter. Much of the facts and much of the applicable law is agreed upon. Really, what we're here to look at today is with 1380-1084, which governs when a cause of action accrues, what is the interlinking between that and 1380-103.51A? When did the amount due become determinable? Because under 1380-103.5, until we have a determinable amount, there is no running of the clock.
What's the language of that provision?
1380-103.51 says that if it's a liquidated or an unliquidated but determinable amount, 6 years is the statute of limitations. And that's why the focus here needs to be, when did this amount become determinable?
Can I ask you a question about this? On the letter by Nalarco indicating that you had possession of the car, Was that an acceleration of the death?
No, it absolutely was not.
Why not?
That letter is actually verbatim from the safe harbor language allowed by CRS 49614. And even the title of that document is exactly the same as in the safe harbor provision, notice of our plan to sell property. And the Colorado Court of Appeals has looked twice at the issue of what constitutes a notice of acceleration. And the Bauer v. New West case had said that it must be a clear and unequivocal affirmative act evidencing an intent to take advantage of an acceleration provision. In this case, that simply never happened. In fact, that's one of the few items that is in the record below. In the transcript from the county court, counsel for the appellant, which was not Mr. Valente, said, and in terms of, you know, when the note was accelerated, we don't have any proof of that. And that's a direct quote. So we believe it's actually admitted in this matter that there was no acceleration. The reason there's no proof of it is it just didn't happen.
I was just going to say, as a practical matter, I was just going to follow up. And how does that play with actual repossession of the vehicle in terms of being an act that shows they clearly intend to accelerate the note?
Well, I think there is case law from other jurisdictions that has said when the actual sale occurs, that is acceleration at that point.
And go back to the repossession. How can that be interpreted as anything other than a clear intent on the part of the?
Because when you actually take the possession, it's a condition precedent to having the sale. You have to gain possession in order to have the sale. To answer some of the questions posed to my opponent, you absolutely must mitigate your damages under the UCC. If you fail to mitigate, 49625 kicks in, which is not just potentially an affirmative defense, it's potentially an affirmative action against the secured holder. Once you're attempting to mitigate those damages, in this instance, the only way you really can concretely mitigate is to try and effect that sale.
Oh, sure, you had plenty of time to do that, though. I mean, the creditor had plenty of time to do that in this case.
Well, Your Honor, Justice Hobbs, I could make that argument about any statute of limitations, and the clock doesn't run until we have the determinable amount, and then you do have the 6 years, and I would argue that 5 years and 364 days is every bit as effective as day two.
I always get confused that the language is accrue. When the cause accrues, remind me the original language in this?
The language from, and that's actually from 1380-1084, which talks about the action accruing.
Action accrues.
Right. And again, we have two positions as to why the statute of limitations was complied with here. Number one is, with a duty to mitigate, with this being a secured transaction, my opponent has been arguing all along the law applicable to an unsecured note. It's a whole different ballgame when there's a piece of collateral that must be dealt with. Surely you can't grab the collateral, sue for the full balance on the note, and then you possess the property and the full balance. That's a windfall that nobody would argue, and nobody has argued in this case, would be allowable. So the fact that the collateral exists and has to be dealt with, you simply cannot possibly have a determinable amount under 1380-103.5 until you sell that collateral. And I should point out, selling the collateral is to the benefit of both parties. It's not inconceivable there could be a surplus, and then that surplus would be refunded. A lot of the cases that we cited from the other jurisdictions talk about the policy considerations behind this. You want to foster the possibility that there could be negotiations between the parties and there could be some deal that goes on between the parties short of running to court. The court asked about what the delay was. There's simply nothing in the record. My suspicion is there were some dealings between the parties, but there's nothing we can cite to in the record because it's so sparse.
Could I just return now to Justice Coates' question, because I'm not sure I quite understood the response to that. And the question as I see it is, you know, why isn't the repossession an acceleration? In your response, you basically talked about how that's a necessary precondition to a sale, and I certainly understand that. But what I failed to understand is why that doesn't clearly indicate that the payments are accelerated. As a matter of fact, why it doesn't, in fact, it seems to me it was associated with the communication that, you know, everything is due, and that plus all the costs and so forth is how you get the car back.
Well, because you still have not had an irreversible act. The parties can still contact each other, they can still negotiate, they can still work out a payment plan. In fact, one of the few items that is in the record, the next notice from Nalarco after the sale occurred specifically stated, please call us and try and work out an installment payment arrangement.
Well, but the parties can always try to work something out. I'm not sure I understand why that there's ever a time when the parties can't work something out.
Well, we couldn't find anything in Colorado that addressed this. We found case law from other jurisdictions.
By this you mean?
This concept of that the wording in the foreign jurisdiction cases was an irrevocable acceleration has not occurred until the sale occurs. The parties can still easily go backward to work something out. The thought process being, once the sale occurs, that's very unlikely that the creditor is then going to do anything other than pursue the full balance. This creditor was willing to, as evidenced by the notice that went out after the sale. But that was what the terminology in a lot of the foreign jurisdiction cases centered on, an irrevocable act of acceleration. That's our position on that. And again, going back to the Bauer case.
You can't leave. I mean, can you help me with any clarity as to why it's irrevocable?
Once the sale occurs?
Well, why the acceleration is irrevocable. And I guess your point is it's not until the sale.
My position is that our position is it's not irrevocable until the sale occurs. Once that sale occurs, it just seems highly unlikely that there are very many creditors who would then say, well, let's work out a payment plan. They've incurred the expense, they've gone through the headache of jumping through the hoops that caused the sale. They were willing to do it in this case, so I suppose you could claim that even the sale is not an irrevocable act of acceleration. But the only concrete authority we were able to find talked about the sale date being the point of irrevocable acceleration.
So, Clark, can I follow up on that? In the letter that was sent, it says you can get the property back at any time before we sell it by paying us the full amount you owe, not just the past due payments, including our expenses. Now, what you're saying is that there's case law in the Court of Appeals that says that's not an adequate triggering of the acceleration clause?
The case law did not deal with this specific letter, to my knowledge. What the Bauer case dealt with was two specific letters threatening about foreclosure. Two letters threatening foreclosure were not effective to trigger the acceleration clause. Now, we have the added fact here. The document you're talking about is entitled Notice of Our Plan to Sell Property. Every single item on that letter is verbatim, including the parenthetical, not just the past due payments, from the safe harbor notice that is reprinted at CRS 49614. And that notice in that form, you don't have to use a safe harbor form, but that notice or a form of it must go out in order to dispose of collateral under the UCC. It's not an optional notice.
That include the fact that you took the property as well? That was seized? I'm not familiar with 49614, so.
I'm sorry.
I mean, this letter says, hey, we got your Porsche.
Right, we have the Porsche.
Does the safe harbor letter
has that language other than
okay, thank you.
Right, no, it's I checked it also. It's a verbatim notice.
Can I ask just one follow up on that? So does the argument about revocability, would that apply even to a letter expressly accelerating the amount, as long as the seller could change his mind and decide to allow allow monthly payments again. Would that not satisfy it?
Of course it would. The seller is in the driver's seat in that regard and can always say, well, sure, I will take the payments. I'll back off on the sale, which would save costs to all parties involved. In fact, this letter also had said you can call in and gave numbers, which you're required to do in the notice. So the seller could always back off.
So it wouldn't matter that a letter to accelerate could be revocable, but it would matter that repossessing the car could be revocable.
Yeah, I don't think it would ring the bell of actually having the sale. I think everything else up to that point, you can.
Counsel, can I just follow up? Is there ever an instance where you decide not to sell the car?
Well, I'm afraid if you did, remember, under the UCC, we have the provision that says all aspects must be reasonable, commercially reasonable. I don't know how never having a sale at any point would be commercially reasonable, particularly with a used automobile. Let's say they waited, addressing the alleged parade of horribles that my opponent put forward in his brief. You couldn't wait 30 years, hold the sale, and then say, well, the 94 Porsche is now worth $2, I'll credit you $2. Nobody would argue that would be commercially reasonable. And that is the safeguard and the stopgap that prevents this from potentially keeping a statute of limitations open forever.
Oh, right, and I mean, I guess that's the point I'm getting to. Wouldn't the statute of limitations, though, just accrue in the 30 years? Now, you would lose the case, right, because your behavior was unreasonable.
Correct.
So I guess you agree that a statute of limitations could run 30 years if you decide to sell the car in 30 years.
No, I don't believe the statute could run because I think you'd run afoul of two provisions of the UCC, the requirement that it be reasonable, and I think you would trigger the remedies provision under the UCC, which would trigger potentially a cause of action against that secured party. I guess a litigant can always try.
Okay.
But it would be a very perilous action. I wouldn't want to represent that position. I'd
okay.
be nervous.
Okay, thank you.
I want to talk briefly about the argument regarding the installment payments. And it's clear under Colorado law, and this is the Cardigan case, In Re Church, the Magna case, each installment has its own statute of limitations. And the interesting aspect in this case is if you look at each statute with its own period of limitations, the date of default could not possibly have been any earlier than May 20th or 1, even under my opponent's position. Last payment was made April 20th, the next payment was due May 20th. So if you exclude the 12 payments that would be arguably outside the six-year statute, and you credit the appellant for the one payment he made, that takes the note balance down to $21,766.25, including the amount credited for, that takes you down to the note balance of $21,766.25. Because the case was in the county court, our client voluntarily limited themselves to the $15,000 jurisdiction limit. So the judgment amount of $15,000 is significantly below the amount that would have been the judgment had they gone to district court and had, if you exclude the 13 payments I talked about. I also think the decision to go to county court and limit yourself to $15,000 as opposed to the $21,766.25 really does shoot holes in the theory in the briefing from my opponent that this was a scheme to run up as much interest as humanly possible. If that were the case, they would have gone to a court of unlimited jurisdiction and sought the most money that they could achieve. They wouldn't limit themselves to $15,000. I see my time's expired. If there are any questions, I'm certainly happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Plotkin.
Thank you, Justices.
Rebuttal, Mr. Valenti.
Thank you, Your Honor, Your Honors. There's a lot of interesting arguments that have been made here this morning, but I think the one argument that is missing is one of the oldest arguments in the book concerning statutes of limitations, and that's vigilance. We have statutes of limitations so the parties remain vigilant. so that they take the steps necessary to continue to move forward to some sort of a logical conclusion. So we don't have, as Justice Ellis pointed out, a 30-year case dragging on with a $2 Porsche. Nobody would want that. But we've looked at the UCC. We've looked at installment payments. The choice of going to a county court versus a district court, that's a choice of remedy that was made by the respondent. The choice to repossess the vehicle, a choice of remedy. The choice to accelerate the payment, and arguably, based upon the letter that Justices Martinez and Coates continued to return to, in October of 2001, the respondents, successors, said, if you want your car back, pay us the full amount. Pay us $22,000 and change. There really couldn't be an installment payment made after that, which I believe defeats the argument of an installment payment. That might be the true triggering point. No more installment payments could be made. That might have started the six-year clock. The default might have started the six-year clock, as we have argued. In either instance, those dates are outside of the boundary of an untollable six-year statute of limitations, which all parties agree applies. Saying that the statute of limitations starts at some other point when its soul just simply does not hold water. For those reasons put forth more clearly in our briefs, we respectfully request that you reverse.
Thank you. I want to thank both parties for your arguments. It's a minute on the briefs.